This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Finally, I want to talk about nuclear power. The important thing for the American people to understand is this concept. For the sake of economic security and national security, the United States of America must aggressively move forward with the construction of nuclear power plants. Other nations are.
The real question is whether Australia should fully consider our interests and responsibilities in the global nuclear energy debate, or whether we succumb to a dogma of denial.
Nuclear power helps us protect the environment.
If Australia does not engage in this debate, if we sacrifice rational discussion on the altar of anti-nuclear theology and political opportunism, we will pay a price, maybe not today or tomorrow, but in 10, 15 or 20 years, Australia will surely pay the price.
Prime Minister John Howard speaking to the Committee on Economic Development of Australia in June this year. Hi there, I'm Tom Morton. Welcome to Background Briefing. And today, should Australia take a step up the nuclear ladder and start enriching uranium? And what would our neighbours think if we did? Nuclear energy is making a comeback. The Prime Minister believes that the public mood has shifted and Australians are now more ready to accept a nuclear solution to global warming. Australia stands poised to join what President Bush believes will be a global renaissance of nuclear energy. The Bush administration's Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, or GNEP, will encourage a whole new generation of developing countries to adopt nuclear power. And for Australia, that could mean access to new markets hungry for nuclear fuel. But GNEP is a highly controversial initiative. Its supporters argue that it's all about sharing the benefits of clean, carbon-free energy while preventing the spread of nuclear weapons.
I think you have to be really naive about history and about technology and about bureaucracies to believe that much of this is actually going to come true. It's becoming more and more clear that this is welfare for the nuclear industry on a scale that vastly exceeds welfare for poor people.
George Perkovich from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Well, today on Background Briefing, we'll hear what they call in Hollywood the backstory to the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, as told by former US government officials and nuclear policymakers. And we'll find out why the global nuclear renaissance depends on a hole in the ground in the Nevada desert and 63,000 tons of nuclear waste.
The hole is there already. I've been in it. I've seen it. And in fact, we can ship waste there and stick it in the ground whenever the license is issued. What we don't have at the moment is the political will to face up to getting the job done.
Jack Edlow, CEO of Edlow International, a company which ships nuclear fuel and nuclear waste all around the world. In June this year, the federal government set up a review committee to look at ramping up Australia's participation in the nuclear fuel cycle. And perhaps the most sensitive issue that the review will consider is whether or not Australia should enrich uranium. The review won't deliver its report until November, but already the Prime Minister has made his view very clear.
Well, we should look at uranium enrichment. Of course we should. We as a nation for generations have lamented the fact that we had the finest wool in the world, but we sent it overseas to be processed. If there's a viable economic safe alternative, I don't want the same thing to be said in future generations about our uranium.
One Australian company which will be watching the outcome of the government's nuclear review with keen interest is Silex. For over a decade, Silex has been developing an innovative new laser technology for uranium enrichment. And recently, Silex signed a deal with General Electric, the largest company in the world, to license that technology in the US. Silex CEO Michael Goldsworthy told Background Briefing that if an enrichment industry gets off the ground here, Silex and General Electric will want to be involved.
Well, the first point I'd like to make here is that I don't believe, even if a decision was made tomorrow, that a uranium enrichment industry could be up and running in Australia inside 10, maybe 15 years. There's a lot of work to do before you can contemplate starting an enrichment industry from the ground up.
Why would it take that long?
Firstly, there is a very divided political environment here in Australia, and I don't think you'll have any company willing to invest $1, let alone $1 billion, in an enrichment industry in Australia until we have a bipartisan political commitment to an enrichment industry. So that's the first point, and I don't think that's going to be resolved in the next few years. But after that, then you have other issues such as the regulatory infrastructure required to manage an enrichment industry and a new nuclear fuel cycle industry. To start a uranium enrichment industry, or more broadly, a nuclear fuel cycle industry in Australia, it will take many years to develop all these levels of infrastructure to facilitate such an industry.
Michael Goldsworthy, CEO of Silex. Well, you might ask, if it's going to take at least 10 to 15 years before we can even get started, what's the big deal? But any Australian talk now about enriching uranium comes at an extraordinarily sensitive time. George Perkovich.
Enriching uranium is probably the easiest way for a country to build nuclear weapons secretly. It's not easy. Enrichment's not easy, and it's very hard if you have to kind of invent it yourself. But it's harder to detect and produces highly enriched uranium, which is easier to turn into weapons. And so there's a real concern when enrichment capability spreads around the world or goes to another place.
In an extraordinary public confession, Pakistan's leading nuclear scientist has confessed on national television to leaking the country's nuclear secrets. South Asia correspondent Jeff Thompson reports.
Abdul Qadir Khan was a national hero, symbolising Pakistan's newfound strength as a nuclear power facing off with rival India. And for years, Pakistan had vociferously denied that it had any involvement at all with the proliferation of nuclear technology.
This is what AQ Khan did in Pakistan. He stole designs for centrifuges and for a centrifuge plant from when he was working in Holland. He was in Holland in the 70s, stole these blueprints, brought them to Pakistan, gave them to Pakistan. That enabled Pakistan then to build its nuclear bomb. He then took those same blueprints and other things that he acquired, and he went around the world selling that know-how and these designs. They're now on computer files where he could just email them to people.
The AQ Khan network secretly passed on nuclear technology to Libya, North Korea, and Iran. This week, Iran defied a UN resolution demanding that it stop enriching uranium. Tehran has consistently argued that under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it has an inalienable right to enrichment for peaceful purposes. But the International Atomic Energy Agency says that Iran has failed to provide conclusive proof that its enrichment program is entirely peaceful. And Mohammed El-Baradei, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, warns that enrichment is the Achilles heel of the treaty. Dr. El-Baradei says that countries can manipulate the treaty to get very close to having nuclear weapons, nuclear ready in the jargon, without technically being in violation.
We now see countries who are trying to apply a much more sophisticated approach, saying we don't really need nuclear weapons, but we need the capacity to build nuclear weapons in a very short span of time. How can we do that? Let us develop the capability to enrich uranium or reprocess plutonium. So I will sit on an enrichment factory. I'll sit in a reprocessing factory. That would give me the chance within a few months to develop nuclear weapons. I'm still kosher. I'm still within the treaty bounds. You know, I'm still not doing anything illegal. But yet, I'm sending very powerful message to my neighbors that I know how to do it, should I decide to do it. And if I, my security perception will change, you know, I can do that in a matter of months.
Mohammed El-Baradei speaking at Harvard. Dr. El-Baradei's stark warning is echoed by Henry Sokolsky. Sikorsky worked in the first Bush administration under Paul Wolfowitz and set up one of the first offices in the Defense Department to deal with non-proliferation. He says that more countries enriching uranium means a much more dangerous world.
Where it leads is a world full of nuclear-ready states. I'll say it's peaceful, but we will not know if there is a crisis how close countries are to getting weapons, and we will be very worried about this. You know, if you think the world has seen a lot of preemptive action to date, hang on. It will be much worse. I remember when I first came to Washington in 1980, early 80s, there was a war that the British had with the Argentines over the Maldives or the Falklands, depending on who you are. And what was the thing that my friends who were analysts at certain places totally preoccupied with and didn't get sleep for literally three straight days? Well, could Argentina make a bomb? We didn't quite know. I think they came down with, well, no, they didn't quite have the capacity. But we were very worried about that. Needless to say, the British were too. Well, that was 1982. You can imagine what the world would be like with countries with more nuclear capabilities and small wars of this sort in the future. There'll be a lot of people staying up very late at night worrying.
The specter of a world full of nuclear-ready states has prompted both the International Atomic Energy Agency and the United States to call for tough limits on the spread of enrichment. But as Iran is proving, any such limits will be a political nightmare to enforce, because the line between peaceful and military uses of enrichment is a difficult one to draw. Here to explain why is Lance Joseph, a former Australian governor on the board of the IAEA.
The enrichment of uranium is a very sensitive, most sensitive activity. As you know, the object of enrichment is to increase the concentration of the fissile isotope U-235 in uranium. The concentration in natural uranium of U-235 element is 0.7%, and the object of enrichment is to bring the level up to 3.5% or thereabouts to allow its use in a nuclear power plant. The trouble is that the technologies required to produce that concentration are essentially the same as required to produce the 90% or more enrichment level for weapons-grade material. It follows that it is a very sensitive technology, and it also follows, I think, that clearly not every country that has a nuclear power program or a nuclear research program, or for that matter, a nuclear mining program, a uranium mining program, it follows that not all those countries ought to be encouraged to go down the enrichment route.
The United States wants to limit the number of countries who can enrich uranium to a small and select club. Under the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, or GNEP, this club would supply the rest of the world with nuclear fuel. Initially, Australia wasn't on the membership list. But just recently, the US has sent a strong signal that Australia may be allowed to join GNEP. And Foreign Minister Alexander Downer confirmed in an interview with Radio National's Frank Kelly that he's been actively discussing the issue with the US.
We're serious about giving it consideration, yes. I mean, the fact that I would mention it to Condi Rice, as I did when I was in Kuala Lumpur the other day, demonstrates that we take the issue seriously. And if we were to go ahead with enrichment, there's a logic to it, because Australia obviously is a very stable country politically. Australia has 40% or so of the world's exploitable uranium reserves, and Australia has been a long-standing and strong leader in the non-proliferation movement. So, you know, looking at it on that basis, it would be preferable for enriched uranium to come from countries like Australia than Canada, than maybe some others, which you might politely describe as less stable.
In a recent interview with the Australian newspaper, an official from the US Department of Energy indicated that the US might be prepared to consider special rules for countries like Australia and Canada. But Lance Joseph says this is an approach which is potentially fraught with problems.
The reality is that very few countries possess enrichment facilities at the moment. Australia might say, well, we want to join that very few, And I guess there are a number of other countries. Maybe Canada may take the same decision. But then, hang on, if Australia and Canada start to enrich, why not Iran? Why not Syria? Why not Libya? Why not North Korea? You can argue that in these areas not all countries are created equal. But political difficulties of rationalising why Australia and Canada should go and join this select group and to deny the same privilege to others, it is a difficult proposition to be able to sustain internationally.
Well, this is the thing. The Bush administration has an approach to nuclear nonproliferation which is based now on making special cases, or put it another way, their approach is not to have rules that apply to everyone, but to make a firm distinction between good guys who are friends of the United States and bad guys who are, you know, what we call rogue states. Australia is clearly a good guy. So in this view, we don't need to have non-proliferation rules that apply to Australia because it's a friendly democracy. So in that way, bringing Australia into GNEP and having Australia do enrichment makes perfect sense when you look at the world that way, instead of looking at the idea of rules that would apply to everybody.
Can I ask you then very bluntly, do you think this approach is a helpful one in preventing the proliferation of this kind of technology and indeed preventing the proliferation of nuclear weapons?
No.
George Perkovich from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
For the sake of economic security and national security, the United States of America must aggressively move forward with the construction of nuclear power plants.
One man who's a strong supporter of the Bush administration's approach to nuclear issues is Jack Edlow. Edlow is an influential player in the US nuclear industry. His company, Edlow International, has more than 100 clients in 50 countries, including Russia and China. And Jack Edlow has been born and bred in the nuclear industry.
Absolutely. And we ship radioactive cargoes, all types of radioactive cargoes, everything from medical isotopes and industrial isotopes through and including the nuclear fuel cycle and waste materials. We ship all of that around the world, in fact, between any two countries in the world.
And you've had direct experience in Australia as well.
Absolutely. Since the early 70s, in fact, we did business in Australia, both for the government facilities, originally the Australian Atomic Energy Commission, now called ANSTO, and as well for the fuel cycle companies there, Mary Kathleen Uranium, who used to provide yellow cake out of their site in Queensland, and then later, of course, for the current mining companies.
Jack Edlow says that Australia should be eager to enrich our uranium and to get on board the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, or GNEP.
GNEP is a very important concept. It was begun by this administration, and they should get great credit for what they're doing here in the United States. It is a very complicated process which needs to reach out to bring together many players from around the world, not just the United States, not just Russia, not just some of the other developed countries. I believe that a dialogue should take place in which many countries can assist to see that this important concept of this partnership can move forward to find solutions to the proliferation issues of nuclear power and the waste issues of nuclear power. And Australia is a primary supplier of the raw uranium, the yellow cake, certainly I feel has a role to play. But I believe this is an important thing for Australia to consider.
You're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. And today, should Australia enrich uranium?
Here's the strategy.
GNEP, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, is an ambitious attempt to solve two of the most pressing problems of the nuclear fuel cycle: how to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons and how to get rid of nuclear waste. GNEP offers developing countries like Vietnam or Indonesia, both of which are talking about nuclear power, a cradle-to-grave guarantee of energy security. Members of the GNEP Club would supply these countries with nuclear fuel for power generation and take back the spent fuel once it's been used. That way, they'd never need to do enrichment or reprocessing for themselves, both technologies which can be used to make a bomb. Well, that at any rate is the rhetoric. But according to Frank von Hippel, what's really driving GNEP is something very different. Frank von Hippel is a physicist and former assistant director for national security in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House.
Well, the G stands for global, but in fact, GNEP really is a response to very local politics. The politics are driven by the demand from the U.S. nuclear reactor owners that the government take off their hands their spent fuel, as it committed to do a couple of decades ago. That the government's problem is that the geological repository in Nevada that this spent fuel was supposed to be placed into is not yet licensed.
So just so that we're clear about this, this is nuclear waste that's coming from power generation companies, private power generation companies all around the U.S.
That's right. There are about 100 nuclear power reactors in the United States, and together they generate about 2,000 tons of this so-called spent fuel each year.
Frank von Hippel. He's had 30 years' experience in nuclear policy making, and right now he's suffering from a case of déjà vu. To understand the real politics behind GNEP, says von Hippel, we have to go back to the 1970s, when the world faced some very similar dilemmas to those it's facing now. It's 1974. Germany's electronic supergroup Kraftwerk are hard at work in the studio recording their album Radioactivity. The oil crisis is starting to throttle the global economy, and the United States is deeply preoccupied with energy security.
In the 1970s, the vision which the U.S. nuclear establishment, which was the leading nuclear establishment in the world at the time, was promulgating for nuclear energy was that spent nuclear fuel would be reprocessed. The approximately 1% of its weight of plutonium that it contains would be extracted, and that would be used to fuel plutonium breeder reactors, which would generate more plutonium than they consumed.
In the early 1970s, reprocessing seemed like the dream solution to America's future energy needs. Fast breeder reactors would recycle spent fuel into plutonium. Instead of a mountain of nuclear waste, they'd create a potentially limitless supply of energy. So great was the enthusiasm for this vision splendid that the US exported reprocessing technology to the developing world. And that was where the vision came unstuck. Frank von Hippel.
The issue was brought to a point when, in 1974, India, which is one of the countries that we had transferred the spent fuel reprocessing technology to, used the first plutonium that was separated from the spent fuel to make a nuclear explosion.
Pakistan's Foreign Minister Aziz Ahmed today voiced deep concern over India's successful underground nuclear explosion at the weekend. He told reporters in Washington that this development represents what he called a new threat to Pakistan's security. Mr. Ahmed said that the subject of the Indian nuclear test would be brought up by his government.
Now, the technology had been provided on the understanding that the uses were supposed to be peaceful. India said that this was a peaceful nuclear explosion, but it really sent a shock through the whole U.S. system and resulted in us rethinking this policy.
So what happened then within successive U.S. administrations? What was the shift in policy that took place in relation to the reprocessing of nuclear fuel?
Well, the first shift was in the Ford administration in the mid-1970s, which immediately changed the U.S. foreign policy to try to discourage the transfer of reprocessing technology to additional countries. But then in the Carter administration started looking at domestic reprocessing as well. You know, it realized that if we were doing something we were telling other people not to do, that might not play very well. And the policy of the Carter administration that they promulgated was, we don't do reprocessing and you don't need to either.
The Carter administration pulled the plug on reprocessing in the United States. But now the nuclear industry had an embarrassing problem, how to get rid of its waste. In 1982, the US government locked itself into a deal that was supposed to secure the future of the nuclear industry. In exchange for a cut of electricity revenues, the government said it'd take the waste and store it in an underground repository. The Department of Energy needed somewhere to put that underground repository, and it already had a pretty good idea where that might be.
This is News 88.9 KNPR Las Vegas at 90.3 KSGU St. George.
Nevada was on a list of about seven states. And because the federal government allegedly owns 90% of Nevada, they thought it was a great thing to put it here. And because we are such a small state, that they figured that there wouldn't be much resistance.
Peggy Mays Johnson speaking to us from the studios of KNPR in Las Vegas. Peggy is Executive Director of Citizen Alert, a group which was formed to oppose the building of a nuclear waste dump at Yucca Mountain, about 100 miles from Las Vegas. The US federal government had been looking around for a site for the waste dump since the mid-1970s, and Nevada had seemed like an obvious choice. The US had tested nuclear weapons there in the 40s and 50s.
What happened was our state legislature looked at passing a resolution saying, essentially, bring it on. You know, they had thought that the Nevada test site had brought such economic development to Nevada, and here was another opportunity for more economic development. Well, in 1975, Citizen Alert started because three women got together and heard that Nevada was on that list, and two of them got in their car and drove around the state and asked people what they thought about it. Well, at the end of their little tour around the state, they had 350 people signed up, which was huge in 1975 here in Nevada. They had 350 people signed up saying, we don't want this. And that was the birth of Citizen Alert, which is my organization.
Citizen Alert has been remarkably effective in galvanizing opposition to the Yucca Mountain waste dump.
In this state, you went from legislators saying, hey, bring it on, this is good for us, to now, in order to run for office in the state of Nevada, you almost cannot be for Yucca Mountain. I mean, it's kind of like a litmus test here. Over 70% of the people in Nevada say we don't want Yucca Mountain.
Radioactivity. It's in the air for you.
It's not a safe place to be putting this stuff. And yet, if this does not open, according to the gurus of the nuclear energy industry, you know, Nevada's standing in the way of progress.
Nobody wants to waste in their backyard. This is not in the good long-term interest of the United States, and will have to be dealt with politically here someday because we're going to need more nuclear power.
Jack Edlow, CEO of Edlow International.
I understand the issue of waste, and we got to do something about it. We got to be wise about nuclear waste. I'm a believer that Yucca Mountain is a scientifically sound place to send the waste, and I would hope that the United States Congress would recognize that as well.
In 2002, the Bush administration overrode Nevada's veto on the Yucca Mountain waste dump. But Yucca Mountain still hasn't been licensed, and the Department of Energy estimates that the earliest it can be finished is in 2018. And that means gridlock for the nuclear industry.
Utilities who wish to order new plants have to make the judgment as to whether or not they have a solution for their wastes in the future. All of them who have plants now have a solution because they've signed contracts with the U.S. government who has agreed to take the waste away from these existing plants. But whether or not they could get a contract for a future plant remains to be seen. The banks want to know, the financiers want to know how the money's going to come back and what the cost of the project is. And, of course, boards would be reluctant to move forward unless they have an outlet for the existing waste. So I think it potentially could be a problem and needs to be addressed because the administration has to decide whether the energy future of the United States will include nuclear. If it does, they need to have a waste solution before people will order more plants potentially.
We said this is an industry that hadn't gotten much going since the 70s. It's an overregulated industry. It's highly risky because of the regulations to try to build a plant. People don't know this, but you get yourself a design for a nuclear power plant. You start spending money for plans and engineering plans and everything. You get building, and all of a sudden somebody can shut you down. And so we got together with the Congress and said, well, what can we do to create incentives to show the industry that we're serious about moving forward?
U.S. President George Bush speaking at a nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania earlier this year. No new nuclear power plants have been built in the United States in the last 30 years. So the Bush administration is offering some incentives to get the industry's spirits up, amongst them loan guarantees, tax credits, and indemnities against legal action. George Perkovich.
What's happened now with GNEP is the nuclear industry and the Department of Energy have been scrambling to find ways to revive nuclear power. And so they came up with this new package that says, look, we'll invent internationally because we actually can't afford or we can't get Americans to invest in nuclear power. But if we get everybody in it together, we might revive this industry. And we'll invent some really cool new reactors that will have these magical properties that they won't allow nuclear proliferation. There won't be an environmental mess. It'll be really cool. And if everybody pitches in together and spends, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, we'll have, you know, a rebirth of nuclear energy.
To assist this rebirth of nuclear energy, the U.S. is now going back to a policy it abandoned 30 years ago. Reprocessing of nuclear waste is a central part of the GNEP package, and it'll cost a projected $100 billion. Critics of GNEP say this is a bad case of the tail wagging the dog, the industry's intractable problems with waste driving a massively expensive welfare program for nuclear power. But Jack Edlow doesn't agree.
Well, I'm sorry, Tom, I don't agree with you. GNEP was conceived of because of the U.S. interest in engaging other countries, such as India and also, frankly, Iran, in a way to try to find to give them a way to access to the nuclear power business without turning over to them materials that or technology that they could use in a proliferation way. That, to me, was the original way forward with GNEP. Later, this waste reduction became a potential and was added to it as a longer-term objective. That's why I say I think there's a nearer-term objective of nonproliferation issues and a longer-term objective also going forward on waste reduction.
I think you have to be really naive about history and about technology and about bureaucracies to believe that much of this is actually going to come true. The U.S. government, the Department of Energy, is already backing off in their private briefings in terms of saying that this will have nonproliferation benefits. It's becoming more and more clear that this is about promoting a dying industry.
Well, my concern is a concern about nuclear weapons proliferation. We have already accumulated in the world about 250 tons of separated plutonium. Now, 250 tons of plutonium is as much as is in all of the nuclear weapons stockpiles in the world. It's a huge quantity of weapons materials. But for us to then say that it makes sense, for the U.S. to say that it makes sense to reprocess spent fuel gives a license to any country that is interested in developing a nuclear weapons option to say we have to do it too. And for us to start a new front in this war for just domestic political reasons, I think is totally irresponsible.
Frank von Hippel, and before him, George Perkovich. The promise to take back spent fuel from overseas was one of the major selling points of GNEP, but that's now looking less and less likely to happen. Henry Sokolsky.
That's what's being said behind the scenes here in Washington in the last month or so, yes. Some officials are indicating that, well, maybe the United States won't take spent fuel from foreign countries. We're hoping, it's being said, that perhaps other nuclear fuel supplying members of GNEP would take the spent fuel so that we wouldn't have to.
Henry Sokolsky, now director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center in Washington. And Henry Sokolsky's news from the corridors of Washington raises an interesting question. If Australia becomes a nuclear fuel supplying member of GNEP, will we be expected to take back spent fuel as well? You're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National.
It is of the greatest importance for the long-term security of Australia.
We will pay a price. Pay a price.
Someone coming.
That the option to make such weapons be kept open.
Opposition leader Kim Beazley has ruled out any move towards enriching uranium under a Beazley Labor government. In a recent speech to the Sydney Institute, Mr. Beazley argued that enrichment would send all the wrong messages to countries in our region, because it would raise the spectre of Australia acquiring nuclear weapons.
There's a strange echo here of Liberal Prime Minister John Gorton's attempts to keep Australia out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and his plans for uranium enrichment in Australia back in the 1960s. At the time, Gorton hid his motives, but 30 years later, he too admitted the truth, saying, "We were interested in this thing because it could provide electricity to everybody, and it could, if you decided later on, it could make an atomic bomb." That's just another reason it's so irresponsible of John Howard to talk up processing without addressing the strategic policy issues that arise. How would John Howard reassure our neighbours that processing facilities in Australia did not reflect wider Australian nuclear ambitions?
Kim Beazley's warnings were promptly dismissed by Foreign Minister Alexander Downer in an interview with Radio National's Fran Kelly.
Well, this talk has prompted the opposition leader Kim Beazley to say that enriching uranium here in Australia would send the wrong message to our region because it raises the spectre of us acquiring nuclear weapons. Have you talked to countries in the region about this?
Well, no, and of course they've not raised it with me. It's a completely absurd proposition, actually, if I may say so. I think it's rather a childish proposition. No country would think Australia was on the threshold of developing nuclear weapons. It's a completely absurd proposition. I think running that kind of scare campaign discredits the leader of the opposition.
But Indonesian political analyst Dr. Dewi Anwar says that talk of uranium enrichment in Australia is already raising eyebrows in Jakarta. Dr. Anwar is a member of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission and a former State Secretary for Foreign Affairs in the Habibie government. Dr. Anwar says that Australia needs to reassure our regional neighbours that we have no desire to get nuclear weapons.
Well, I think that's very important. It's part of the confidence-building measures. I think it's very important that Australia does assure the international community that it will not add another security threat to the already very unstable global situation at the moment. Indonesia and the ASEAN countries would probably be concerned about Australia doing uranium enrichment until we get more details of this.
We have to look at the perceptions of our neighbours. The fact is that senior Indonesian officials and military people have expressed concern at the thought that Royal Australian Air Force is going to be armed with long-range cruise missiles to be attached to its FA-18 aircraft and the F-111, which could be capable of carrying nuclear weapons.
Richard Bronofsky is a former Australian ambassador to South Korea and Vietnam and author of Fact or Fission, The Truth About Australia's Nuclear Ambitions. Richard Bronofsky says that both our past history and current defence planning give neighbours such as Indonesia good reason to be concerned.
We have in the past had a record of developing or wanting to develop nuclear weapons. And there was, throughout the 50s and the 60s, a strong feeling in the Australian military and in the Australian Conservative government of Bob Menzies and his successors, either to acquire or to develop our own nuclear weapons technology in Australia.
In the 1960s, prominent figures such as the head of the Australian Atomic Energy Commission, Sir Philip Baxter, publicly argued that Australia should keep open its options to make nuclear weapons. Here's an interview with Baxter from the ABC archives.
Could I ask you then, would you say at this time Australia should make the decision to acquire the capability to produce nuclear weapons? Whatever the technology required to do that, but in principle...
Well, can we be quite clear just what you mean by that question? I do not think that it is necessary for Australia to make nuclear weapons at this point in time. But I believe that it is of the greatest importance for the long-term security of Australia that the option to make such weapons be kept open.
Australia gave up its option to acquire nuclear weapons when it ratified the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1972. So, is there any evidence to suggest that defence planners in Canberra might be reconsidering that option now? Richard Bronofsky.
I don't think there is such an ambition at this stage. I think what the most you could say is that there are people within government who would like Australia to have the capability to develop nuclear weapons technology and indeed nuclear weapons if push came to shove, if we had to do it. That's been a theme in the past, and I'm sure it continues to be a theme, carefully guarded within the corridors of certain departments in Canberra.
My own view is that Australia's commitment to international atomic energy safeguards, its record on non-proliferation, the fact it is a non-nuclear weapons state, the fact that it's not in Australia's interest for a regional arms race, I think that's very clear given our economic interests, all of those things taken together make it highly implausible that countries in the region would read any sort of darker intentions into Australia's decision to enrich uranium.
Andrew O'Neill, Senior Lecturer in Politics and International Studies at Flinders University. Any Australian move to start uranium enrichment would have implications which go well beyond our immediate region. Martine Letts is a former Australian Deputy Head of Mission to the International Atomic Energy Agency, and she's now Deputy Director of the Lowy Institute for International Policy.
There is a lot of bad will in the international community about the way in which this issue has been handled in the past. Particularly countries in the developing world and in the old non-aligned movement have always seen this debate as the developed countries wanting to keep all the technology to themselves and the returns that come from that technology and deprive them of the development of an indigenous capacity. In an environment where there is great concern about further proliferation of sensitive technologies and the fact that the development of a domestic capacity to enrich or to reprocess could facilitate the development of a nuclear weapons capacity, for Australia to develop that capacity at this sensitive point might send an example to many other countries that if Australia can do it, why can't we?
Martine Letts. Indonesia is one of the developing countries currently looking at nuclear power as a way of meeting its future energy needs. Indonesia recently announced it would begin work on its first nuclear power plant in 2010, and it's planning to build at least three more. And Dewi Anwar says that Indonesia may also consider uranium enrichment further down the track as well.
Indonesia would also have the right to enrich uranium as long as it is for peaceful purposes and within the IAEA safeguards.
But if Australia were to go ahead with uranium enrichment, would there be pressure in Indonesia for Indonesia to follow suit?
Well, I think so, because Indonesia would not want to be totally dependent on a few nuclear suppliers.
Many countries in the developing world say they don't want to be dependent on a cartel of Western countries, such as GNEP, for their nuclear fuel supplies. It's an issue which has been weighing heavily on the mind of Mohammed El-Baradei, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. In his speech at Harvard late last year, Dr. El-Baradei pointed towards a possible solution.
Is it really rational for every country to develop their own enrichment factory? Well, the answer is absolutely no. You know, these are sensitive technology that if countries want to use that technology for their own economic social development, they can. But let us multinationalize this operation. Let us regionalize this operation. So no one country alone can have their hand on highly enriched uranium or reprocess or plutonium, the material they need to develop weapons. But it should.
What Dr. El-Baradei is suggesting here is a different model to the Bush administration's Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. Instead of limiting enrichment to an exclusive club, the GNEP model, Dr. El-Baradei wants to bring any new enrichment facilities under multinational control. A couple of years ago, Dr. El-Baradei set up an expert group to look at ways of doing this. Lance Joseph was a member of that group. He argues that an important first step would be for the International Atomic Energy Agency to guarantee a supply of nuclear fuel to any new country wanting to adopt nuclear power. And this would remove the need for any one country to do enrichment on its own, thus raising suspicions about its possible intentions. Lance Joseph.
Let me be specific. Iran is arguing that it has every right to enrich uranium, that it has those rights under the NPT, and that it needs to enrich uranium because it needs to ensure that the supply is there to fuel its nuclear power program. As long as there is no option, no alternative, and as long as Iran can point to a situation where it's been sanctioned in the past, as it's sanctioned today by the US bilaterally, and it was likely to be sanctioned in future, perhaps multilaterally through the Security Council, as long as Iran can point to that, they can develop a rationale that they do indeed need to enrich for their own peaceful purposes. Now, if you have a multilateral alternative, an IAEA guarantee alternative, you remove that pretext. Iran can no longer invoke that reason. It can no longer say there is no satisfactory alternative.
But a country who had noble objectives in this regard, who was only interested in getting enriched uranium for peaceful purposes, might not feel the need to exercise their rights on the NPT to do it themselves, to do it domestically. They may be prepared to rely on this international mechanism.
Lance Joseph, if this idea for a guarantee of supply of nuclear fuel does actually get off the ground, then Lance Joseph would like to see Australia take a leading role as a supplier. But as Martine Letts says, it'll be phenomenally difficult to make it work.
It will require an enormous leap of faith and political compromise for this proposal to get the political support it requires to even get off the drawing board. That being said, I don't want to be negative about this. I just think that the obstacles are quite formidable, and you certainly can't blame the agency for giving it a good college try, because the alternatives are even worse in many respects.
Which are?
Which are the unfettered indigenous development of nuclear technologies, with the risk that countries that suddenly decide they don't want to adhere by their safeguards obligations will simply leave and continue without international supervision.
If Australia does decide to enrich uranium and export it, it's not unlikely that we'd be asked to take back the spent fuel as well. We could be looking at a Yucca Mountain all of our own. But Richard Brunofsky says that's a question we'll have to confront.
If the government was fair dinkum about non-proliferation and wanted to go ahead with enrichment, it would insist that as part of that package, Australia would commit itself to leasing our fuel and bringing it back to Australia to be disposed of in Australia. Of course, that's not a popular political suggestion to make among the NIMBYs in this country, but nevertheless, that's what Australia should do if it was logical about enriching and at the same time ensuring that there was a foolproof system.
So you're saying effectively the only way to be absolutely certain that nuclear fuel that we might sell to another country is not being diverted for a weapons program or something it's not supposed to be used for is to actually ensure that the fuel rods we send out come back to us.
There are two ways of doing it. Either that you just described, or leave the stuff in the ground until we have renegotiated a more realistic, foolproof nuclear non-proliferation agreement.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Technical production today was by Russell Stapleton, research and web mistress Anna Whitfelt, and our executive producer is Chris Bullock. And you can find links and further information on a whole range of nuclear issues discussed today on the Background Briefing website. I'm Tom Morton, and you're listening to ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.